A pretty busy show Monday, July 27th, kicking off the final week of July right here on Connecticut Today. Author and longtime attorney Robert Katzberg joined us in the 3 o'clock hour to talk about his new book, in which he laments how the federal court system uses fewer and fewer jury trials anymore. In the 4 o'clock hour, portions of a news briefing from Governor Ned Lamont. Late in the 4 o'clock hour, former Democratic State Representative Chris Caruso joined in to give us the latest on the controversy surrounding the Bridgeport Christopher Columbus statue. And in the 5 o'clock hour, Canton GOP State Senator Kevin Witkos, a former law enforcement officer, gave us his thoughts on the current police reform bill. Cum laude graduate of the George Washington University Law School, he went on in his legal career to prosecute many high-profile political corruption and financial crimes. How good is our guest? Well, one prosecutor, a federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, described him as the best cross-examiner he'd ever seen. That's high praise for Robert Katzberg. The name of the book is The Vanishing Trial, The Era of Courtroom Performers and the Perils of Its Passing. Robert, hi. Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I am fine, Paul. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Doing well here, Robert. Now, I got the promotional materials for this book, and I said, well, wait a minute. What's going on with jury trials here? I knew you could have trial by judge, Robert. I knew that you could, plead down cases, keep the assembly line going, but are we having a problem here with the theory of a jury trial in the U.S.?
I'm afraid so. It's a problem in the federal system. As you know, there are two levels of criminal justice system in the United States, the federal, and each state has its own laws and regulations to impose on the criminal side. But my book, based upon my experience, is federal, and that's really the most significant level of criminal justice in the country, because that's where the federal government puts its enormous pressure and its enormous power. It imposes that power on the states. It imposes that power on corporations. It imposes that power on individuals. And so that's really the highest level, the most important level of our criminal justice system, and that is where trials have been disappearing. That's where jurors have been basically eliminated from the system.
Okay, so let's start basically, Robert. Why is that happening on a level, as you say, the federal level, which really gets a lot of the spotlight on these major trials that involve, politics and big corruption versus some of the local trials that, some people are interested in, but these are headline trials. Why are there fewer jury trials?
Well, I'm sure you can hearken back to the 1980s, when the national mood was basically lock them up, that if you and I were running against each other for Congress, if you were tougher on crime than I was, then you won. And what happened was this tough on crime, lock them up attitude caused the Congress of the United States to decide that sentencing in federal criminal matters was too important to leave to judges. And so they created a thing called the Federal Sentencing Guidelines. And under this Rube Goldberg type of system that ascribes numbers to characterizations, to characters of crimes, did it take more than minimal planning, how much money was lost, those kinds of things. And they came up with this formula. And under the formula, they took away the discretion of judges. And they said, here is what the sentence must be between these amount of months or that amount of months. Mm. And what happened was these guideline sentences were much higher than the judges had been giving beforehand. Plus, before the guidelines, they had a thing called the parole commission, where if I went to jail for 5 years for whatever offense I committed, after a third, I was eligible for parole. The guidelines did away with the parole, and you had to serve 85% of the sentence. So you had to serve a much longer mandatory period of time in jail on a much longer sentence. And so between 1990 and 2000, which was a decade of low crime, in that decade, the federal prison population doubled. And between 2000 and 2005, it doubled again.
What kind of crimes were we talking about here? Drugs, corruption, guns?
Everything.
Really?
Everything.
Okay.
Everything in Title 18, which is the basic statute that governs federal criminal trials, Title 18 of the United States Code, and under the tax code, all sentences became longer, and you had to serve 85%, not a third. You had to serve 85%, and that's why the number of prisoners went crazy during this period of time. Now, as a result of that, as a result of these mandatory guidelines, and they eventually became, quote, advisory, but didn't change things much, but the point is that it became much too risky to go to trial.
Mm.
Before the guidelines, if you lost, okay, most judges would not hold it against you.
Yeah.
That you stood behind your rights and you wanted your case tried. Now, once the guidelines came in, you were facing much, much longer sentences. You could do much better by pleading to something lower, lesser, and avoiding it. So the numbers are just startling. Before the guidelines, 10% of all federal criminal cases went to trial. 10%. By the last year we have statistics for, 2018, that 10% is 2%.
Wow.
98% of all federal criminal cases are adjudicated without a trial. As there's a very famous judge in New York named Jed Rakoff. He's a judge in the Southern District of New York.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He has described it as the system is now operating, and I'm quoting now, behind closed doors.
Wow. Robert, hang on. I want to dive more into this fascinating stuff. The Vanishing Trial is the name of the book, The Vanishing Trial, The Era of Courtroom Performers and the Perils of Its Passing. Robert Katzberg is the guest. Robert, hang on. Back to you after we do traffic and weather together here on WICC. Fascinating book here. It's brand new. The Vanishing Trial, The Era of Courtroom Performers and the Perils of Its Passing. We are joined by the author, longtime federal prosecutor, and then he flipped on the other side and defended folks as well. Robert Katzberg is the guest. You know, Robert, your book here is getting great reviews. I'm looking at the Amazon reviews, and there's one person said something here I thought that was very interesting. They pointed out, they said that you point out a harsh reality that relaxes the burdens of prosecutors and what they have to prove and how they prove their cases, and deprives defendants of the constitutional rights that may have been violated. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I think that is certainly one of the elements of the problem. I mean, the Vanishing Trial has created lots of problems, and that is certainly one of the most important problems. To me, the biggest problem is the exclusion of the average citizen from the federal criminal justice process. You know, Paul, I don't have to tell you, there are only two ways that the average citizen can impact his or her government. The first one, obviously, is voting. And obviously, that's the way that people maintain the democracy that we have. But the only other one is jury service, is serving on a jury. That is the way that the average citizen plays a key role in the functioning of our criminal justice system on the highest level. That's why it's put there in the Constitution. And if, you know, jurors, citizens are aware when their voting rights are threatened, when either, you know, there's redistricting or whatever it is. But why I wrote the book is that the average person has no idea that they're being cut out of the criminal justice system. And I want the public to know that, because it's been called by a famous lawyer, Mark Garagos, the dirty little secret.
Yeah, I saw that.
I don't want it to be a dirty little secret. I know about it. All of the criminal defense lawyers know about it. All the judges know about it. All the prosecutors know about it. But why is it that otherwise really smart and well-informed people have no idea.
When this system, Robert, was put into place, as you say, and it spawned out of the mandatory minimums. I remember when that came in, it was a very contentious thing. And I know judges don't tend to say a lot. They kind of, you know, do what they do, and there's kind of this professional thing that you stay out of politics. But was anybody from the bench when this was put in say, hey, wait a minute, this is not going to end well?
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's a great question. And, you know, people think, well, it's a liberal thing, it's a conservative thing. No, it's not. It's more than that. To give you just one example, Justice Scalia, who's not known as a bleeding heart liberal, right? He was very much against this system. His famous quote: Congress passed the statute, the sentencing reform statute, what they called it, okay, the guidelines, and they created something called the Federal Sentencing Commission, which was this group of people that oversaw and implemented the guidelines. Justice Scalia called them the Junior Varsity Congress.
That's great.
And that was no compliment.
He was okay? great. So, that was great.
Okay, and so you have judges on all ends of the spectrum who find the system to be ridiculous and have found it to be inappropriate. Are there some judges who are fine to have these things taken off their hands? Sure. But the level of unhappiness, so to speak, is pretty substantial and has been for a while. But the law is the law. And the judges, while they can make speeches, while they can write articles, and many of them have, they have to follow what the statute says.
And as you said,
unhappily.
Yeah, as you said earlier, Robert, judges do have, and they have to rule by the law, obviously, and they have to kind of act as referee in contentious trials. I get all that. People know that. But as you say, judges still can exercise discretion. And we've seen that, and that's not a good thing. Look, I'm a legal dummy here, but even I know that when a judge can say, hey, wait a minute, let's look at all the factors here, if there's some sort of artificial limit to that, that can't be good.
No, it's not, and that's why, frankly, a lot of judges don't like it. You know, if you have been living your career, you see, the newer judges aren't used to the old system, okay? The newer judges who came on after the advent of the guidelines, and that's most everyone now who came on 88, 89, 90, this is all they knew. But the older ones, they knew a different world, and they are much more satisfied with the older world than the present world. And it's just crazy. But one of the things I would like to come from this book is the kind of acknowledgement, realization by the public of what's going on. What I've tried to do is to make it a realistic portrayal. I'm trying to reconstruct what the era of abundant trials was, with the great lawyers in the big cases, so that the public would know what they're losing. You know, we watch TV and we see on the movie screen these ridiculous portrayals of trials, which have nothing to do with reality. You know, all the trial lawyers I know, they stay away from these movies and TV shows, just like the doctors stay away from the medical ones because they're ridiculous. So what I've tried to do in the book is to recreate the era of these really top lawyers. And these in actual cases, I name the judges, I name the lawyers, I name the prosecutors, so that the public will have an idea of what is being lost, of what we're losing, and what we have to desperately move ahead as fast as possible to try to change.
One more break, and then we'll come back and wrap it up. A fascinating discussion, more straight ahead, with attorney Robert Katzberg. The name of the book is The Vanishing Trial, The Era of Courtroom Performers and the Perils of Its Passing. Traffic and weather together right here, 3:46 on WICC. New book, fascinating premise. The author, Robert Katzberg, The Vanishing Trial, The Era of Courtroom Performers and the Perils of Its Passing. Robert, obviously, you've been steeped in this for decades. The era itself and the courtroom performers, particularly on the federal level, the federal cases that you were in, the white-collar cases that you participated in, a name or two or three or an anecdote or two or three that stand out to you that you describe in the book that people may not be familiar with in this situation. Who did you cite here, a couple of names? Who did you look up to in this era?
Well, I have separate, not really chapters, part of the same chapter, of some of the real courtroom superstars that I was fortunate enough to try cases with. You know, you don't really know how good somebody is until you are in the well of the courtroom with him or her, and you're aware of the facts, you're aware of the strengths of your case, you're aware of the weaknesses of the case. And you're aware of the task at hand. And so I limited in the courtroom sections of the book those cases that I actually tried cases with, those lawyers. And obviously there's one name that most people know, which is Ben Braffman.
Mm-hmm.
And he just extraordinary superstar. And there's a lawyer from Chicago named Pat Tewitt, who has since retired.
Yeah.
Another amazing lawyer. These people just took over the courtroom. They would walk into the courtroom, and just their very presence was just extraordinary. And it's impossible over the phone now. In the book, I go through all of these cases that I had with them, and just show how and why they were just so brilliant and why they were so good.
Are those kinds of attorneys on both sides of the case, Robert, are they born or are they self-made?
No, that's a great question also. As I say in the book, there is no law school equivalent to Juilliard, where you can be screened for playing the cello before you're admitted, and they realize, boy, this is a talented young man or young woman. Law school admits people based upon scholastic criteria only. You can't learn how to be a trial lawyer until you start trying cases. Trial lawyers are the functional equivalent of stand-up comics. I don't know who your favorite stand-up comic is, Paul, but one of mine is, Chris Rock.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and if the first time Chris went up on the stage at 2 in the morning when some cafe owner let him get on there and people were gone or drunk or both, he wasn't funny.
Yeah.
It took him time after time after time, day after day, week after week, to perfect, to learn how to tell jokes, to modulate his voice, to put his act together. It's the same thing in the courtroom. It's performance art. You're standing there. When a cross-examination works, it's there for everybody to know. And when it bombs, when it fails, it's just as obvious.
And you have and you have a jury there. You have an audience.
You have an audience.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. I mean, sure, there are people maybe watching from the gallery, but you have those 12 people in the box, right? And I think the fascination, Robert, for just average Joes like me, you know, watching a trial going, wow, are they buying this? You know, it's fascinating stuff.
The way, you know, jurors come into a courtroom and none of the Latin that's used or the expressions that are used or the procedures that follow mean anything to them. They don't know anything. They have no frame of reference. But here's what they know. They know human beings. They know people. And they study you and they watch you.
Mm-hmm.
And how they view you cannot be separated from how they view the case. If you have time, I told this story in the book about a colleague who was in a long trial.
Okay.
And after the trial was over, he interviewed the jurors. Sometimes you're allowed to have these things. And a woman said to him, you know, we always knew when your cross-examination would be long or when your cross-examination would be short before you even opened your mouth.
Huh.
And he said to her, how was that possible? She said, it was easy. When you had a long cross-examination, you would unbutton your suit jacket.
Oh, my God. That's funny. It's like
short one, you left it buttoned.
It's like telegraphing a pitch. It's like a pitcher telegraphing a
pitch. Totally correct. Now, he was totally unaware of this tick.
Wow.
But the jurors were all over it.
I would hope, Robert, that whomever that juror was got a check from the guy. I would have. I don't know legally. I would have said, here's a consulting fee. Thank you.
Exactly, Robert.
It has been fascinating, Robert Katzberg. A long legal career on both sides, prosecutorial and defense and white collar crime. Check out the book, folks. The Vanishing Trial: The Era of Courtroom Performers and the Perils of Its Passing. Robert, thank you. It's been fascinating. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right, there you go.
In a little over a month. But first, let me give you a quick daily summary. Actually, it's a three-day summary since Friday. I think of most interest to me at this point is the fact that 207 positive cases out of about 32,000 tests performed. That's about a 0.6%, less than 1% positivity rate. And Josh reminds me, we've now had a 1% or so positivity rate over the last month. So there's, for now, a fair amount of consistency there. And obviously, being able to maintain a low infection rate is key to everything we want to try and do a month from now when it comes to schools, et cetera. One of the ways we're trying to protect ourselves, we're not an island, but as you know, we've worked very hard to limit the number of folks coming into our state from those very highly infected states. I think we're at about 31 states at this point, so it's a lot. Fortunately, none of them are neighbors, so that's very helpful. We have good neighbors. We started moving to the online form, so we captured not just folks flying in from Texas and Arizona and Florida and those other states, but also those who may be driving in. Maybe they catch a flight in LaGuardia Airport, then they're driving up from there. And so the online form allowed us to track and see who's coming into the state and where they'll be staying. And we announced that, I think, on Thursday, and you can see here we've had 5,000 of those forms filled out since Thursday. That's a really good thing. That just tells us that, fortunately, people are voluntarily taking this quarantine very seriously, for which we're most appreciative. A number of calls as well in the 211. I asked Josh, where are most of the forms being filled out? And by far, the number one is from folks getting out of Florida and coming up to Connecticut. So some time ago, we always thought about a lot of people leaving Connecticut for Florida. Well, 25% of all the inquiries and forms filled out are for folks leaving Florida at this point. I will tell you, just in terms of protecting ourselves, one other thing I just want to highlight for you is we've had some parties, and those parties have carried with them a fair number of infections. A couple down in Fairfield County where, we were, there today with Brian involving young people coming in from out of state, then others a party, one involved vaping, and a lot of people sharing that. So we've got to be very careful there because those are where the flare-ups have come before. And but I'll tell you, the folks who find out who's hosting these parties, people were not very happy with them. So there's a fair amount of accountability just informally done that way. I think finally you can see this is the sign you see when you land at Bradley Airport. You need to self-quarantine for 14 days. And I think a majority of people are doing that. All right, let's tell you top line what I'm hearing from the schools. I think we did a survey. We heard from about 231 different school districts. Miguel Cordona and his team, based upon a lot of feedback from teachers and parents and some students who've been actively involved, the survey came back, which was quite interesting. Survey found that about three quarters, 76% of students expected to and looking forward to actually going back to school in the fall in person. We can talk about that in a minute, but very important to a lot of the students that I've had a chance to meet with as I've gone around the state. They miss their friends, they need the socialization, and maybe not kids of every generation, but these are looking forward to getting back to school in the classroom. I was a little surprised that 81% of teachers expect to be in the classroom teaching this fall. Because I've obviously heard a lot of feedback, a lot of concerns from a number of teachers in terms of public health and such. So we'll see how that sorts out over the course of the next few weeks. Some of the concerns were, A, about public health from the teachers. And again, I remind people the state is there to backstop every single one of our school districts when it comes to public health and public safety. We'll be there for the PPE. We'll be there for the masks. We'll be there for the disinfectants. We'll be there to do everything we can to make sure, from a public health point of view, you're safe. And for those students who don't necessarily feel confident going back into the classroom quite yet and think they'll probably be more likely to telelearn and be learning from home, we have made a big priority. We'll be backstopping all of our superintendents in terms of the technology they need to be able to Zoom in and out of that classroom so they continue to learn remotely. As you know, we previously purchased 60,000 laptops through the Connecticut Partnership and the Dalio Foundation, and we've about doubled down on that now by purchasing another 50,000, I think it is, Chromebooks, which are going to get distributed to those folks who don't think they're ready to go back into the classroom, so we can take care of them. And it's of interest to me that if, say, three-quarters of the kids are going to be in the class, 25% aren't, that, of course, leads to more spacing in the classroom as well, which I think is one of the important criteria. You know, the number one criteria for getting back to school safely is the metrics, making sure we keep a very low infection rate. You know, number two is the masks. That buys us a lot of safety for young people and teachers. Number three is cohorting. And I think we found, and Miguel will speak about this in a minute, cohorting means you stay within your group as much as you can. So if there is an infection, it just infects your class and the such. And that's why we found great interest, almost unanimous, in K through 5 in-person education, easier to cohort, most important years, least likely to be able to distance learn, have them in the classroom. And from there, we're maximizing flexibility for all of our superintendents, right? You got that, Brian? Flexibility. And because we heard from middle school and then high school, every district has a slightly different way they want to be doing this, trying to emphasize getting kids in the classroom, but only if we could do that very safely. 54%, just a little over half, thought that they'd be taking the bus to school. That was very interesting because we'd like to be able to maintain some spacing in the buses, even with the masks. Some of the financial questions that came back to us from superintendents was, hey, if I had to double down on the number of buses, how do we acquire the buses? How do we pay for the buses? Well, this may be self-resolving itself if we find that either a number of kids, a quarter of the kids don't go to school, maybe another quarter prefer to getting to school a different way, not on a bus, and all of a sudden you've got a little additional space there. And finally, as you can see, many people are still unsure, say, 20 to 30%, and times will change. But I just want everybody to know that as we talk about education, talk about how important it is to get these kids back in the classroom, public health is going to be our priority number one, two, and three for teachers, superintendents, and all the powers that are there. And finally, before I introduce Miguel, who can introduce our superintendents, here's just a short. I've gone to a fair number of the local districts. Obviously, I was in Fairfield County today, where Brian was, New London just the other day. I was in Ansonia, West Haven. Two of the kids from West Haven, they really emphasized that they miss the classroom, want to get back in the classroom. Teachers are doing what they can with Zoom, but the interaction, I think, is what makes the classroom so special. And I've heard that from teachers. I've heard that from students. And I think you'll hear that from our superintendents as well. Miguel, you want to kick things off?
Sure. Thank you, Governor. I'll be brief because I know it's really important that people hear from folks that are in the districts, coming up with plans with teams. But before I do that, I want to take a moment to thank the districts for their work over the last several weeks, developing plans, well-thought-out plans, 231 plans we received as of Saturday afternoon, thanks to the hard work of everyone. And that includes principals, teachers, parents who are on those teams to develop these plans. So thank you for the work you've done. Currently, we are reviewing, as I speak, we are reviewing plans. We have a team of 10 here assembled at the agency, led by Chief of Strategic Partnerships, Keith Norton. He's doing that work. And, you know, it's important to note that these plans not only talk about technical changes, whether we're talking about cohorting or distancing, physical distancing, but it's also adaptive shifts. How we're rethinking education now, because we know this is not going to happen overnight. These changes are not going to fix themselves overnight, that we have to shift the thinking and the belief system around public education. I said it before, this is a public education emergency, and we're going to step up to make sure that we're meeting the needs of our learners, getting them in the classroom, because that's where they learn best. We know distance learning doesn't make up for in-classroom learning, but it's critically important that you hear that health and safety will trump whatever decisions are made. We know that we have to make sure that we're thinking about health and safety. We also have to communicate that these plans are fluid, that just because it was turned in Friday doesn't mean that that's the plan that's going to start on day one. It's really important that the plans evolve with our learning of what the data is, but also how to promote health and safety. So I just want to reiterate, the goals are to get our students in our schools. We know that students with special needs, students that are English learners, students that have been disengaged in distance learning, are more likely to suffer if we don't get our students back in schools, but we have to do it with health and safety first. I want to introduce Dr. Lutze from New Canaan, superintendent, and Superintendent Cynthia Ritchie from New London, who worked really hard. And they're going to talk a little bit more about their specific plans and their thinking moving forward. So I'll turn it over to either one of you who would like to speak first.
Sure. I'm happy to speak first on behalf of New London. First, thank you so much, Governor Lamont and Commissioner Cardona, for all of your support. This has truly been a team effort, and I can say that I think the adults learned just equally as much as students do day to day, from school closure all the way to our reopening that occurred this summer for our partial summer school, and as we made our plans and submitted them to you on Friday. Our plan really focuses on core beliefs that are safety, equity, flexibility, collaboration, and excellence in programming. And our goal was to make a plan that could be fluid back and forth. So we color-coded our school reopening plans to be green, which means full in-person come back to school opening, yellow, which is signaling our hybrid model, which is a 50% capacity, and red, which means we are back to distance learning because it is not safe for everyone to come back into the building. And throughout that plan, we really focused on improving instruction so that instruction can be fluid throughout. So we want students to have a top education, whether they have to learn at home or whether they are in front of a teacher. And we don't want parents to stress about having to fill a void if they have to make a decision for a specific health need, for example. So we have spent a lot of time digging deep into instructional practice and making improvements for that. And you can just imagine that comes with not only training for students, but we have a robust plan for training for staff now. It's our hope that instruction in the classroom could go fluid from being there one day, and then if we have to close the next day, you still know the assignments, you still know how to use your technology, you still know where to access the standards and the assessments, and parents are well informed of the units of instruction that we are trying to deliver. Staff have been a huge part of this, and our survey data is very much aligned with the state's overall data, and those numbers tell a lot. People want good education for their students, but everybody wants everyone to be safe, and we share in those goals. And therefore, we hope our comprehensive plans that offer this green, yellow, and red opportunity and to do education differently in some new environments will really make a difference, and we can get our students back in school. We really miss them. Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be recording some videos to actually show parents the day in the life of what school may look like or what your teacher may look like with a mask. To help alleviate some of the maybe fears of how is school going to look and get students used to the new way of educating. I will say so far, our summer school program, that is a small program, but it's in person, has worked very well. And it's so great to see life in our buildings again of staff and of students coming in. So I am excited about what the future has to bring.
Great. Well, I will be glad to go from there. Thank you, Governor Lamont. Thank you, Commissioner Cardona. I'm very happy to be here with you today. And Governor Lamont, thank you for traveling to New Canaan and meeting with us this morning. It was a wonderful conversation, I think very lively. You can tell a room full of very dedicated, passionate superintendent and educational leaders, and we're all grateful for that and for all that you're both doing and everyone around the state is doing. You know, we've been hard at work at schools across the state since the moment we closed, trying to figure out how can we get our kids back in schools. And I can tell you, nobody wants students back in schools more than our educators. You know, we miss them. This is what we do. We've dedicated our lives to helping students and to helping them to grow and to learn. And we are focused every day on figuring out how to do that and how to do it safely. We all know that it's the cumulative results of our collective efforts that'll determine our metrics. And so we're focused on implementing the mitigation strategies that you outlined in the document, in the reopen document. We're trying to figure out how to do that well and safely and do it in an educational environment. For instance, we are cohorting our elementary students. You know, we're looking at keeping those classes together throughout the course of the day. We're doing the same in our middle school, although it's not a class at a time, it's more of a grade level team. But Governor Lamont, you mentioned flexibility. It's very difficult to cohort at the high school for a variety of reasons, including just the nature of adolescents and teenage students and our programming things. So some flexibility there will be a wonderful boon to us in our planning, trying to figure out how best to do this work. We're designing opportunities for our students for mask breaks. You know, we recognize that that is a significant mitigation strategy, and we need to incorporate masks into our day. But how do we make that work with kids? Superintendent Ritchie mentioned before the summer program. We've had a very successful summer program going as well, small scale, but we found that our students are comfortable wearing the masks and they're able to keep them on for a long period of time, which is wonderful. We still need to build in those breaks, but also thinking that some of the angst around mask wearing is probably adult-centered, and our kids are really flexible and adaptable and resilient, and we've seen that throughout the summer. Essentially, you know, with social distancing, we're working to take spaces that were designed for collaborative work and figure out how to do set them up to be distance. And that's been a challenge, but we're emptying furniture out of classrooms. We're figuring out how can we try to stay at a reasonable distance from each other with our students, with our teachers in the front, and yet still have interactive type activities. Because, you know, schools these days are not sit and get. They're active, engaged learning environments. And so we want to make sure that that level of engagement continues regardless of sort of the modality and the furniture setup. So we're working hard to figure that out too. How do we continue to deliver world-class educations to our kids and do it in this sort of, in this new venue? One of the ways we're doing that also is looking at outdoor spaces where we can. You know, whether it's tents or courtyards, putting up shades, that, identifying places students can go, making sure the technology is robust enough to support that work and allowing classes and students to go outside, get some fresh air. We know that that's better, at least that's what the health department is telling us. For our students who are home, whether it's by choice through remote learning, or we're also thinking there may be students who aren't feeling well, and we're encouraging anyone not feeling well to stay home. You know, that's an important mitigation strategy as well. And we may have others who, because of their own circumstances, have to quarantine for any reason. So we're developing a robust live streaming system that will continue to deliver the education folks know and expect in our classrooms, but also providing it to students who log in from home. There's a lot of work to do around that, and our curriculum program has been working on that all summer long. But in order to train for what we're going to see in the fall when students return, we're bringing teachers back a little bit early for a full 5 days worth of training. And then we're looking at an onboarding program for our students when we begin as well, because school is going to be different. You know, they're going to be asked to do things they haven't been asked to do before. Instead of traveling to some classes at the elementary, the classes will travel to them, things like that. So we need some time to help them understand how that works. And we're looking to gradually do that in the beginning, and then on the fifth day, go to our full model, whatever that may be. Certainly, we've developed the models around different levels of community spread, and we're continuing to do, you know, to do that work and to further refine those models. But you know, all in all, these are immense challenges, and as always, as we work through all of what we are single-mindedly focused on doing the right thing for our kids, for our parents, for our community, for our staff, making sure that whatever we do, we're guided by the health and safety of all members of our community, and are grateful for the partnerships that we have locally, regionally, statewide. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Brian. Thank you, Cynthia. Please stick around. You get some questions from the feisty Connecticut Press Corps. Max, over to you.
News 8.
Good afternoon, everyone. Governor, before I ask you and the commissioner questions about the reopening, if I just may ask you about the news out of Springfield about Bay State Medical and the outbreak there, do you know at this time if any of the people affected are from Connecticut?
Do you know that?
No, we just recently heard news about that outbreak at Bay State Medical. Myself, Josh Jabal, and Commissioner DJ Gifford are looking to obtain more information on that. But yeah, that news just came to our attention right before this press conference.
Okay, and Governor and Commissioner Cardona, there has been, with the positive, the low infection rate, that would seem to suggest the return of kids into the classrooms. There is some talk around about a plan or the plan to be maybe announced on Thursday, but I would think that because this is so fluid, would you both agree that you need to wait as long as possible before announcing exactly what the plan will look like?
Yeah, it certainly won't be Thursday, and I think you're absolutely right. We ought to spend a little more time. We're getting really good feedback from teachers and superintendents, as you can tell. And we're going to know a lot more about the metrics. As you know, as we've said many times, we're only going forward with plan A or B, full or, hybrid, subject to our being able to maintain a low infection rate, public health first. Yeah. And we won't have that for sure, but try and give schools at least a two-week notice. Isn't that about right, Miguel?
Yeah, that's right, Governor. We know that the health data will drive this. We're doing well in Connecticut, and I'm glad to see that. But we're also making sure that we continue to build those plans so that we can move back and forth as needed.
Fox 61.
Hello, a quick question before I get to my education questions as well. There have been a lot of complaints lately about the electric rates in Connecticut skyrocketing over the past month. A lot of people are now signing petitions online trying to get those rates down because in an already difficult time, they're seeing these higher rates now. Governor, do you have any response to those people and those electric rates?
Well, my understanding is the rates haven't gone up yet. But the bills maybe went up because many more people are at home. It's been very hot. Air conditioning is on. So my hunch is bills have gone up. We did just get indications that there'll be about a 4% electric rate increase instituted by Eversource, I think it is, in the next cycle. You know, about half of that is related to transmission. That's dictated by the federal government, and that's universal around the whole country, I think.
Okay. And my other question is about education, and maybe this could be for the commissioner or even the superintendent there in New Canaan. You know, we're hearing from a lot of realtors that people are moving into Connecticut because of the way that we've handled the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of those people coming into Connecticut because they want their children in Connecticut schools, especially in Fairfield County. How do we address, one, that influx of new students coming in, and two, what it's going to cost to educate them?
So I feel Dr. Lutze could elaborate if you'd like, but you know, we're noticing that because Connecticut is doing well, people are looking at Connecticut. We want to make sure that the same health and safety standards that we have for the students that we know about now are kept moving forward. I think that's critically important to hear first. And we also know that many of our districts are very transient. So we anticipate that in some districts, people are going to be moving from one part of the town to the other, and we have to account for that. And also throughout the state of Connecticut, there are several communities in Connecticut that have a very high transient rate. So we just have to be prepared to accept students, to welcome them, but also to make sure that we're maintaining those same health and safety standards that should drive every part of our plan. Brian, I don't know if you want to add to that.
I can just add, just locally here, we are seeing enrollment increases across the board. In the summer, we generally meet once a week to take a look at our enrollment to be sure that our staffing is appropriate. Now we're meeting every couple of days to take a look at it because of the unknown, you know, as we're figuring this all out. But we are seeing some increase, and so we are adjusting our staffing accordingly. We've had to bring on board a few new staff members in the elementary level in the last couple of days, and we'll keep watching it and keeping an eye on it because the class sizes are so important always and even more important now. So we're keeping a close eye on it.
A just-announced version of As the Statue Turns, yet another page in what is going on with the statue of Christopher Columbus. Safely, I guess, ensconced somewhere out of harm's way. Chris Caruso joins us again. Chris, how are you? What is the latest update? What is going on?
Well, Paul, I just got word that the mayor has called a special meeting of the city council for tomorrow night. I believe it's at 6 o'clock, and the legal summons that have to be served on the city council members are being served at this time. So, you know, finally the mayor's decided to call the special meeting, and at the meeting, the only item on the agenda will be restoring the Columbus statue to Seaside Park.
What made him do this? Was it, in fact, in your mind, Chris, the threat of further legal action here if this didn't happen, or did he just figure, you think, well, let's do it and let's not have to wait till the regular council meeting in August? What changed here?
I think it's a couple of things. I think the writ of mandamus that would compel the court to, you know, order him to hold the meeting probably had some, reason in getting him to call the meeting. I think, you know, him ignoring the city council is never good, because he has to work with this body throughout the year on city issues. So I think that plays with something. And also the mounting pressure around the city, you know, that he needed to do this. He needed to take the issue on and allow the council their say and eventual vote on the matter. So I think it's a combination of things. And probably the writ of mandamus, if I were to gamble at all, would be the reason that got him to call the special meeting. I don't think any mayor wants to be brought into court and have a court call on him to have the special meeting. It would be a terrible waste of taxpayer money, and frankly, there would be no justification, because the city charter is crystal clear that the mayor has to call a meeting when three or more members of the council ask him to do so.
So, Chris, what do you think happens here? What happens at that meeting? What if you had to predict, and I know that's tough, Give us your best bet. What do you think happens?
Well, you know, I kind of think it will pass the resolution to restore the statue. I'm sure the mayor has picked off some city council members' votes, you know, got them to change their mind from the original 14. But, you know, if I were to think, I feel there'd probably be at least 11 to, you know, compel the mayor to restore the statue. And I think there's a lot of things going on. But I think the question of fairness, that there were negotiations going on before the mayor impulsively took the statue down, I think that weighs on city council members' minds. And also, I think the city council coming of age, if you will, feeling that they have as much say in the governance of the city as the mayor does, that they're a co-equal yet separate branch of government. And so I think it's a combination. But, you know, my feeling is the mayor, you know, will pick off some votes. I'm sure he'll talk to some council member and persuade them not to support the resolution. But, you know, I kind of think there'll be the majority to get it through.
What happens, Chris, do you think, if the statue goes back up and the city perhaps won't or can't, for reasons, provide any security for it?
Well, I think at that point, then we should just disband the entire police department, because if we run scared of threats against the statue than we're going to do with everything in the city. And frankly, in Bridgeport, there's a command center where almost every bit of territory, 17 square miles that comprise the city, is under camera. So the statue can also be put under camera if that's the way the council, you know, or the city decides to do it. There's surveillance techniques. There's other opportunities as well to protect the statue. You don't need to have 20 police officers to protect the statue. And there's other ways to protect it. But again, if we're willing as a city to succumb to the protests and the threats, then we're willing to do anything. I think I've mentioned it before. Then let's, you know, if the protesters want to burn City Hall, then let's open the doors and hand out matches on their way in, because that's what it comes to. You know, you've seen, for example, in New York, when Andrew Cuomo said the statue under his watch will not come down, there hasn't been these massive protests. The same thing in Waterbury. When the mayor said, I'm not taking the statue down, there haven't been these massive protests. And the one incident in Waterbury where the head of the Columbus was taken off, the person who stole the head has been arrested and will face now both state and federal violations.
And Chris, so it is kind of interesting that since the president signed that executive order, you know, promising and stiffening federal penalties for going after these federal statues, gee, nobody's gone after the statues on federal property anymore.
That's right, Paul. And, you know, I think it's, you would know that I don't agree with the president on every issue, but on this one, I, you know, that you have to show people who want to conduct themselves in a lawless way that it's not going to be tolerated. You know, that, you know, there's a fine line between the rule of law and chaos. And if we're not willing as citizens to stand up and say there's a lawful way to remove a statue, mm-hmm. and threatening and you know, just barbaric ways of taking the statue down is not going to be tolerated, then we open the door to abuse on everything.
All right, Chris. And on that note, my friend, I'm sorry, I'm up against the time-wise. So, Chris, thank you.
Okay.
We appreciate it. Chris Caruso, thanks for calling in. So, the State Senate tomorrow, 36 men and women get together and handle and see what they will do, debating and voting on the police reform bill that passed after some very contentious debate in the House last week. Our next guest is State Senator Kevin Witgoes of Canton, longtime legislator, member of the State Senate, and a 28-year veteran of law enforcement, retired law enforcement officer. Kevin, Paul Pacelli here. It's been a while. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Paul. How are you?
Very well, very well. Thanks. Well, you folks, men and women, 24 Democrats, 12 Republicans, going to look at this bill tomorrow. Kevin, what are your initial thoughts on the legislation that came to you from the House?
Well, my initial thoughts, I don't think it was well written. I think it was rushed. They were still authoring the bill at midnight, so when the bill was brought out at 1:20 in the morning, most legislators never had a chance to read the final version before they were voting on it. At least in the Senate, you know, we've had the opportunity since last Friday to read the bill. And there's a lot of things in there, I think, that do harm to police. It defunds the police. And it's something that I don't think Connecticut should be known for.
Kevin, you said a couple of things there that I have friends of mine who know I do a show like this ask me on Facebook. I have people that call these types of shows all around the state, saying, wait a minute, never read most of the bill and voting on it in the as Frank Sinatra used to say, in the wee small hours. Kevin, why does this always happen? I'm very frustrated with this, as are thousands of state residents.
Right. And, you know, this was a bill that could have been taken up during the regular session in January, where we could have vetted it, had a full public hearing, allowed people to come and testify. Both in person and submitting testimony in writing, had it gone through the full committee process before it was actually debated in the House and then ultimately into the Senate. Unfortunately, people took advantage of a really bad tragedy situation, basically a murder out in Minnesota, and translated that into, we have to do something here in the state of Connecticut. And so we're going to rush this bill through a special session and they couldn't agree to it with the parameters within the bill in their own party, because, as you know, the Democrats control everything. So they had difficulty within their own caucus reaching an agreement. That's why the negotiations went well into the night until they finally had a bill where they thought they had the vote. And they did. As you know, there was a tie on an amendment, which failed on a tie. So the controversial piece of the bill stayed in, and ultimately it was basically along party lines, the vote.
You served in law enforcement for all close to three decades. Honestly, Kevin, explain in your own words, and I know people have probably asked you this ad nauseum, qualified immunity. Talk about how that relates to a police officer's job, what he or she thinks and knows that affords them, and what could change if qualified immunity is stripped away from law, from police in Connecticut.
So qualified immunity really is a protection from frivolous lawsuits that are filed, could be filed against the police when they're just doing their normal police job and do it within their scope of their duties. And I give an example. There's a car accident. There's somebody bleeding profusely below the knee. The officer gets on scene, puts a tourniquet on just above the knee to prevent loss of life. The patient actually survives, goes to the hospital, and the doctor makes a determination that the leg has to be amputated below the tourniquet. Well, now this potential person could be filing a lawsuit against the police for a loss of limb or, you know, changing of their lifestyle. Whereas before, with qualified immunity, the police officer would be protected because they were just doing their job. That protection goes away. So the officer's home, his savings, his investments, everything that they work for he or she or their family, is up for grabs. And speaking with prosecutors, there's no downside to somebody filing a lawsuit against the police officer for anything now.
Now,
so
yeah.
You're going to have the cops that are on the job now, if they're eligible for retirement, they're going to retire.
You know,
and the
yes.
quality and the caliber of people coming in are not going to be as good as what's there now.
And Kevin, I've heard that over and over. But if you and I plan to have some Democrats on tomorrow to talk about this, but if you ask Democrats, and I've seen this written about in the various publications across the state, they say, well, no, there is still some immunity for police. They can still be defended by the city or town. Now, is there any immunity available in this bill, Kevin, or is this all going to be taken up by the city or town and they're going to have to write the check?
Well, the towns, you know, one of the towns that I represent has already investigated the cost of providing this type of insurance, and they got an estimate of $20,000 per officer. And that's why I say it's going to defund the police, because this is an unanticipated budgetary item that the town's going to have to bear the cost for. So if you come from an urban police department, which are very large numbers in size, imagine providing that insurance for every single officer that's involved in your department. So, no, this is another unfunded mandate on our cities and towns.
Final question, Kevin. Was this simply rushed through, do you think, because we're coming up on the November elections?
Absolutely. There's no reason why, you know, we haven't had an issue with the millions of contacts that our local law enforcement, our state troopers make every single day with the general public. We haven't seen this type of activity that we saw out in Minneapolis. And that's what they're trying to base this on, to get momentum, to go forward, to say we're combating this in Connecticut. And look what we've done. That's why it's being done right now before the November election. Shame.
Kevin, is there, and let me ask you one other last question. Do you think, and I've prodded people on this for the past couple of days, contacts I have at the Capitol. Do you think there is any shot that the Senate can stop this, or is this just going to be bull rushed through here?
Well, I think that police officers and family of police officers and the citizens that admire the men and women that go to work every single day and put their lives on the line to protect us, they're reaching out to their state senators, urging them to reject this bill. There are some good things in that bill I support wholeheartedly, but unfortunately the bad outweighs the good in this bill, so it's got to be rejected.
Kevin, thanks. We appreciate it. We'll talk down the line. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, Paul.
All right. Thanks. That's Kevin Whitcomb.